Okay, good morning, everyone. We have to give a special award for the people who survived the whole term.
You need a
medal, don't you? No, that's okay. Normally with a smaller crowd I would sit, but there's a live streaming because some people are watching online, so I'll keep standing. So, last week we started learning some lessons of Pesach. We talked about gratitude. And we connected gratitude to the Seder. The Seder is all about gratitude. We talked about the importance of gratitude, how we have to train ourselves to have a mindset of gratitude, and so on. Today, I'm going to focus on the actual Pesach experience. And we'll do it in two parts, one this week, one next week, and I'm going to explain. So, many, many times we've spoken about this idea that when we have the Haggadah, we have the Seder, we don't, in Jewish tradition, we actually don't celebrate history, we re-experience history, right? So we re-experience the concept of freedom. So just like we mark the event of the Jewish people leaving Egypt and becoming God's nation and being freed from slavery, so we know that on Pesach, what that means is that there's a special energy of the concept of freedom and liberation. And there's more over there on the top there, on that shelf over there. Yeah, right. Sorry, on that, there should be more over there. Well, there's a box there in the corner which should also work. So, we have this concept that when the Jews were in Mitzrayim, the word Mitzrayim, as we've spoken about many times, means borders, constriction, and it represents an inner spiritual slavery, not just a physical slavery. And that on Pesach, we have this concept that we take the next step into personal freedom. And that's what the Seder is all about, right? Personal freedom means that freedom, we've defined many times, but just in the context of today's discussion, to just go over it again. Freedom doesn't mean the ability to do what we want. That's a misunderstanding of freedom. Freedom means the ability to choose to do what we need to do to go beyond ourselves. That's what freedom is, right? I've often shared with you that when I was a teenager and I started to read stories on the Holocaust, it always puzzled me then, doesn't puzzle me anymore, but it puzzled me then how there were stories of Jews who got together in the concentration camps and made a makeshift Seder, and they celebrated whatever they could in terms of the Seder. Sometimes they risked their lives to find a little bit of flour and to make a small matzah. They gathered together. They didn't have wine, obviously, but they tried to recite passages of the Haggadah as much as they possibly could. Many, many stories like that. And I always wondered, like, how could you sit in such terrible, adverse environment and celebrate freedom? But the truth is that we know that when I learned more and matured more and understood these concepts of what freedom is, I began to ask the question the other way around. Maybe they were more free than we are. What I mean by that is because freedom has nothing to do with the environment. Viktor Frankl, of course, talks about this, but it's an age-old Jewish idea. Freedom has more to do with how we feel in terms of what we do and what we choose to do. And sometimes what we choose to do is difficult. And, you know, Viktor Frankl talks about that they tried to dehumanize him in the camps, and he said they could take everything away, but they couldn't take his perspective away from him. And he felt free. He was free, right? So the fact that sometimes we sit down to a beautiful Seder that we're really free in the freedom sense, in the modern freedom sense, but nevertheless we're still slaves to ourselves, sometimes we're stuck and sometimes we're prisoners of our own temptation and indulgences and limitations and inhibitions and so on and so forth, that makes us less free, not more free, right? So the Haggadah tells us that in every single generation, we're supposed to see ourselves as if we are going out of Egypt, our own personal Egypt, freeing ourselves from ourselves, go beyond our comfort zone, grow and take the next step. The Rambam quotes this line, he says, "Bechol dor vador," every single generation, Chayav Adam, a person is obligated, Leharot, that on the Pesach night, on the Seder, you're supposed to show, you're supposed to display freedom, you're supposed to show that you actually are really intrinsically free. Now, and we are taught, this is a concept we always have to do. Growth is something we always have to engage in, but particularly when it comes to Pesach, there's an energy of freedom. God gives us a gift, so to speak, to be able to take a leap, to be able to take a step forward in our own personal spiritual journey. You know, there's a concept that I think we've spoken about this before also, before I get to what we're going to do today. The word Pesach means passing over, jumping over, skipping, right? There's a verse in Tanakh where it describes God coming to redeem us from Egypt, and it says, "Medaleg al heharim," he skipping, jumping over the mountains to come and take us, right? Take us out of Egypt. So Pesach is very much this imagery of skipping, of jumping. Now we know that a human being always has the capacity to grow, right? That is just what we are. That's what makes us different to angels. As we've mentioned many times, that an angel is something in Tanakh is referred to as omdim. They stay in one place. They might be holy or even perfect, but they don't grow. They are who they are. Their personality, which angels have a personality, are what it is, and they don't grow in any way. But they might be very holy, but they don't grow. A human being who makes mistakes, and we're not so perfect, but we have the capacity to grow. And that's a whole year round. But Pesach is like a special energy, because the reason that we call, because we, the angels are called omdim, they're called stationary beings. And in Tanakh, human beings are referred to as mehalchim, those that walk, unlike angels. Angels stand in one place, we walk, which means we grow. But in growth itself, there's different types of growth. There's a growth where you walk. What does walk mean? Walk means incremental growth. And that's okay sometimes, and that's okay many times, and sometimes it's a good idea. But it means also that when you put one foot forward, your other foot is still where you were. In other words, you're not completely disconnected. You haven't completely made a complete break of where you come from, right? Whereas jumping is different. When you run or you jump, you lift both feet off the ground, which means you take a quantum leap. You completely disconnect to where you were before. And sometimes we need to do that. And Pesach is that time. Pesach is an energy of complete quantum leap type of growth, where we take a complete jump. And we think of something where we can grow into that's completely different to where we were before. Now, in order to do that, we have to become unstuck and we have to be able to grow, right? So there's two parts to inner freedom. One part we're going to talk about today, one part next week. When I say the two parts, the one part is strategy. In other words, what do we have to do to actually grow? What do we have to think about? What do we have to do? How does one grow? How does one do it? Okay, that's strategy. And we're going to actually learn lessons from the Seder next week in order to understand what the strategy is of growth is. But before we can implement strategy of growth, there's something more important than that. And that is having hope and believing that we can grow. We can become untrapped. We can become different. Right, that's a prerequisite to all strategies. You can talk about all strategies in the world, but if someone believes that they're stuck in who they are, there's no potential for growth. And that becoming unstuck has a lot to do with hope, believing in ourselves, believing in the inner human ability to actually grow, to change, to improve, to take the next step, to go beyond ourselves sometimes, transcend our own limitations. That's the first thing we need to inculcate. That's the first thing we need to absorb, is to have that hope and that belief that we actually can do it, we can grow. Because human beings so often, and especially, we said this when we talked about the anxiety series, that especially today where we live relatively comfortable lives, comfort is beautiful, but it brings a problem. It brings that intolerance for being uncomfortable, which is a problem because growth requires discomfort, right? Not negative, but hopefully not challenge or not adversity, but growth requires one to be uncomfortable, to do something that's uncomfortable for us, right? So that's why even more today, sometimes we feel, no, this is who I am, this is what I'm comfortable with, this is what talks to me, this is where I'm at, and don't hack me in China, as I say in Yiddish. Like, don't talk to me about growth because I am who I am. And this is my lot, I've had challenges, and this is why I that's it. I'm too old for it, right? Another very commonly, that's good for the youngsters. They can grow. But for us, we've been doing the same thing for too long. We're not interested in growing. So, big mistake and big problem, right? They tell a story of there was a great master of ethics called. He was the founder of the Musar movement, as they call it. His name was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And he once went he once went for a walk in the street at night and it was dark. The shtetl was very quiet, everyone had gone to sleep, but he saw through the window the tailor standing next to a candle, it was not a Christian in those days, and still working, still fixing, mending, making alterations on garments and things like that. So he went up to the window and he knocked. The tailor saw Rabbi Shlomo Salanter, he got up and he said, "Hello." So Rabbi Shlomo Salanter said to him, Why are you working so late?" So he answered in Yiddish, he said, "Kol zman de lichtel brennt, kan man noch verrichten," which means as long as the candle is still burning, this, we can still fix stuff, right? Yeah. So Rabbi Shlomo Salanter walked away and he was so inspired. He said, "I've learned from this tailor a life lesson. As long as the candle's still burning, as long as the soul is still there, we're still alive, we can always fix. We can always improve," right? So that's the concept. But we have to have that hope. We have to have that belief in ourselves that we can actually do it. Hi. You want to grab a handout if you want this? Okay. So, how does that work? What does it look like? First of all, let's look at the Seder. The Seder teaches us that lesson. And I want to share with you two insights, first of all, before we go further. First one is, part of the Seder is the Karpas. I want to share with you ideas today that maybe not only will talk to this idea of giving us hope that we can actually do it, but also will provide you with some insights that you can share at your Seder table, hopefully. So if you don't remember everything today, there's always a recording afterwards. You can relearn it. You can re-listen to it. So one of the things that the Seder is the Karpas, right? Different people have different things for the Karpas. Right after Kiddush, there's the first washing of the hands, and then there's the Karpas, the vegetable. Does anyone know why we have Karpas? Just a bit of general knowledge here. Why do we do this? Why do we have the vegetable to say this? Sorry? That's a great attitude. I love that. Compliance, surrender to a higher truth. That's fantastic. But as much as surrender is a good thing, it's also good to understand what's going on. So let me share with you. So the simple reason is because it's strange. That's why. One of the themes of the Seder is that we arouse curiosity, right? The Seder is contextualized in parents talking to children, right? That's the idea. And children asking questions. That doesn't mean necessarily the child has to be 10 years old. It can be 90 years old too, but because we're all children. But it's the concept, right? It's the concept that the story of God, of Exodus needs to be told in response to a question. It's an answer to a question. Because of that, one of the themes of the Seder table is to arouse curiosity. Now, the child knows that the normal order of a Friday night or a Yontif night is that you make Kiddush, you then go wash, and then you eat a meal. Eat matzah, eat challah, right? What do we do on Pesach night? We make Kiddush, we wash, and then we eat a vegetable. We dip a vegetable in salt water. So obviously that would create a question like, why are we doing things different, which is exactly what we want to achieve. That's the simple reason why we do that. We eat this little vegetable dipped in salt water before the meal, which we don't normally do, and it arouses curiosity, it creates a question. But you can do that with lots of different ways, different strategies. The way it's done is it has to be a vegetable. Some people eat parsley, some people eat cooked potato. In Chabad, we have a very interesting custom of using a piece of onion. Not the greatest choice in terms of taste, but that's the custom. Whatever it is, it has to be a vegetable. It has to be something which Jewish law tells us that the blessing you make on it is borei pri adama, something that grows from the ground. And I once saw a beautiful idea behind that. Because right at the beginning of the Seder, again, the Seder has this tremendous spiritual energy where we're able to achieve freedom, right? And then you have those negative people or skeptics of themselves, who say, "No, growth, like I said before, growth is not for me. I'm too far gone. I've failed too many times. I've dropped to very low levels." So what do we say? What do we remind ourselves of right at the beginning of the Seder? Remind ourselves that we take a little vegetable, which is, as we say in Yiddish, tifindrer, that's like buried behind, deep in the ground, right? That's where the vegetable is. And what happens to the vegetable in 1 second? We put it on the Seder table, and it has a lot of yichus all of a sudden. It's part of the Seder, right? It's part of the Kadesh Shurachat. It has a prominent place in the Seder experience, which is symbolic of what takes place on Pesach night by the Seder, that we're able to take this leap. We could be at a very low level, just as the Jews were in Egypt. We are taught that when the Jews were in Egypt, they had sunken to the, in Kabbalah, it talks about 49 levels of impurity, balanced by 49 levels of holiness. But the Jews had come to a point where they were so, the Jews, by the way, weren't very holy when they left Egypt. Right? It wasn't like it was a holy nation. It wasn't. They were came from holy stock, meaning we were children of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, and so on. But and God had made a pact and a promise to our forefathers, patriarchs and matriarchs, that He would take us out. But we actually weren't very holy at all. In fact, we had become very assimilated through being in Egypt. Yes, we identified as an ethnic group that was different than everyone else, but we actually had become very assimilated to the point that Egypt was a very strongly pagan society, and we had become part of that. And we had sunk into very, very deep levels, almost to the point that we weren't able to free ourselves, and God gave us that gift. He revealed Himself to us and took us out. So that's the theme of the Seder night, that no matter what level you have sunken to, you might be a vegetable right down there in the ground, but in the Seder, you become part of the Seder experience, and you can do it. That's that. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of what it means that become assimilated, I'll just share with you a very fascinating... It's okay. I'll just share with you a fascinating insight from the great Maharal of Prague. I think I shared with you a Maharal last week. I did, yeah. So the Maharal has this fascinating book on the Haggadah. Beautiful, beautiful insights. And he brings a medrash. And the medrash says, based on a verse in Tehillim, which describes the exodus from Egypt as God taking out the gold from the fiery furnace, right? We were trapped in a furnace of Egypt, and God took us out. But the Medrash says two things. The Medrash says that just like a goldsmith or a silversmith takes the gold or the silver from the burning furnace, so too God took us out of Egypt. And then the Medrash continues and says, and just like a farmer helps the animal give birth, in other words, he extracts the animal and assists the process of the animal giving, the cow giving birth to the calf, so too God took us out of Egypt, right? And the Maharal of Prague asks the following question. He says, why do we need the double imagery? What would be wrong if the Medrash just stopped with the very first idea that we were in a fiery furnace, meaning a very, very challenging environment, and God took us out, which was a miraculous event? He says, no, the Medrash continues and gives another image. Cow is pregnant, it's about to give birth to a calf, and the farmer assists the process to extract the calf from the cow in order for it to be born, which also is symbolic of what happened when we left Egypt. The prophet Ezekiel says that Egypt was the birthday of the Jewish nation. We became a nation, we were born. But why that second imagery? And he says the following. He says like this. When you have a piece of gold in a fiery furnace, the gold is being consumed by the fire, but the gold is a separate entity, right? So taking out the gold from the furnace is a skill, and it's difficult, and it removes and extracts the gold from the furnace, but the gold was never really a separate, the gold just remains a piece of gold, but it just was taken from a very, very difficult and very dangerous environment, right? That's the concept. The calf being born, however, says the Maharal, means that the calf was in the mother's womb, was a fetus. And the Talmud tells us that Ubar Yerech Imo, it's got all sorts of halachic consequences of this phrase, which we're not going to go into now. But the Talmud says that Ubar, a fetus, is really a part of the mother. In other words, the idea of birth, the greatness of birth, is that suddenly there's an independent life. Right? There's life before a person is born, but that life is not a separate independent life, it's actually part of the mother's identity. It's called Ubar Yerech Imo, right? And the Talmud discusses it, and there's all sorts of halachic ramifications of this concept. Says the Maharal the following. There's two ways to be trapped in a country. There's two ways that the Jews could have been trapped in Egypt. The first way was, and this is how it began, that they were enslaved. In other words, and the Jewish people have had this throughout history, that we've been in certain regimes in certain countries where we are distinct people. We are different. We like the gold in the furnace, which means we have our own unique identity. It's just we're being oppressed and persecuted by a foreign nation. Correct? That's one way. That's the imagery, he says, of God taking out the Jews from Egypt like a piece of gold from a fiery furnace. However, he says something worse than that. that the Jewish people would be like a fetus before they were taken out of Egypt. Meaning, not that they were a separate entity being driven mad by a foreign nation, but they become part of that nation. They'd assimilated to the point where they now identify with that nation. That's very different. And it's very different, and our history tells us that it's very different. Sometimes looks better, but is worse. Right? I think it's a very relevant thing to think about now, actually, but we'll get that in a second, right? So this goes back to what we were told, that what happened was when the Jews were in Egypt, that they actually become part of Egypt. There is Midrashim that tell us that they did retain a certain independent identity, but nevertheless, they were part of Egypt. They become part of the idolatry of Egypt. They become part of the culture of Egypt. In fact, one of the reasons why before God sent them out of Egypt or took them out of Egypt, He instructed them to have a Seder. You know that, right? The first Seder was not after Egypt. First Seder was the night before they left Egypt. Did you know that? So the Jews had a Seder the night before they left, and they had matzah and maror. They also had a paschal lamb, all right? First Seder was in anticipation of the redemption, not in commemoration of the redemption, right? Because it was a prerequisite. What did they do? One of the things they had to do was they had to bring this Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, which we commemorate today by having a shank bone or a chicken neck, whatever, roasted meat, on the Seder table, right? Now, what was the point of the Paschal Lamb? In fact, not only did they have to bring a Paschal Lamb as a sacrifice on Erev Pesach, but they actually had to take it a few days before. On the 10th of Nisan, they took each family took a lamb and they tied it to the bedpost and had to call it there for 4 days. What was the idea? The idea of them doing that was because the Jews had assimilated into Egypt, into the pagan worship, and one of the pagan practices of Egypt was to worship a lamb. It was the Avodah Zarah, it was the idol worship of Egypt. As bizarre as this sounds, although it's not, I mean, we have this today, you know that. In India, they worship cows, I think. Yeah. Right? There's a culture where they worship. What's that? Yeah. Right? We're not that much more sophisticated. We worship other things. Right? But plenty of...
Why is it so crazy to eat lamb on Pesach?
Yeah, because the idea was like this, right? We don't have to eat lamb on Pesach, by the way. In fact, on the first night, we're not supposed to eat roasted lamb. You know that?
Are you not supposed to?
On the first night, you're not supposed to eat roasted lamb. You can eat cooked lamb, because we put a shank bone to commemorate the Pesach, but we don't eat it because we have roasted meat on the Seder plate. We specifically don't eat it on the first night because we don't have a temple, so we're not permitted to eat sacrificial meat. So we don't want to, doesn't shouldn't look like we're eating a sacrifice, so therefore we don't do that, right? So on first night we have pot roast or cooked thing or cooked chicken, whatever, or pot roast. You can mix a little bit of liquid. But you're right. The question is, why did they ate it? I mean, they ate it. Why did they eat it if it was part of the pagan worship? That's the idea. The idea is that when the Jews had to leave Egypt, God told us that you need to disconnect from the idolatry of Egypt. And the way you do it is to take the very thing that you worshipped, take it for 4 days. So it'll be a process of transition. You'll get used to the idea. It won't just be a sudden inspiration. It'll be a thought out process where you're making a statement. Because in Egypt it was a crime to slaughter a sheep, a lamb. Right? It was something terrible because it was their God. So you're going to take it and you're going to actually bring it as a sacrifice, which was completely contrary to the pagan worship, the pagan practice, and that will be your move away, right? And why do they need to do that? Because they had so assimilated with the culture, they become so one with it. Right? And that's part of the miracle of Egypt. Yeah. I think it's something that we're reminded of now, because a Jew can really never be properly assimilated, right? We know that, unfortunately, from many, many historic concepts in Judaism, but we know it now. It doesn't matter. We are alone. We've been forced into our own identity now, whether we want to or not, right? And no one's looking to see how religious we are, and how secular we are, and how frum and not frum. It's not the point. The point is every Jew is a Jew, right? No one asked the question on October the 7th, how religious you are to be persecuted, right? As we saw in the Holocaust. Sometimes as we saw in Purim, the Purim story of Purim, same thing. The idea was to annihilate Jews just because they're Jewish, right? So that's an important lesson to think about now when we talk about the Seder, to understand that we have an identity, but sometimes that identity is hidden. And when it comes Pesach, the idea is not just to be freed from an oppressive regime, the idea is to be freed within ourselves. In other words, to move away from becoming part of a different identity and express and nurture and build and develop our real identity. And that's the second imagery of the Midrash, that God didn't just take us away from being enslaved. He extracted the calf from the cow, meaning that the calf should be now an independent being, not part of the mother. Not being part of a different culture, but being your own independent, unique existence. And that's part of what Yetziat Mitzrayim is all about. But it does mean, again, going back to what we spoke about before, it does mean that as much as we might have become part of a different identity, and therefore making it much harder to be redeemed, to experience personal freedom, Pesach does that. There's always hope. No matter what we've done, no matter how assimilated we become, we can extract ourselves. We can experience personal freedom. We can experience that exodus of Egypt. There's a related thing, which I don't know if you saw this, but Rabbi Moss put out a beautiful article last week. It's interesting, just general knowledge thing, but also related to this idea. You know, one of the things we do on Pesach night is we eat maror, right?
Yeah.
The translation of maror is mar, bitter, supposed to be bitter herbs. Now, you can eat horseradish, which is bitter. Some people have the custom to do that. But actually, we know that you can fulfill the mitzvah of eating maror with lettuce, correct? Cost lettuce, maybe. So he raised the famous question, which is brought, and people ask it, that, like, how can you eat bitter herbs and eat lettuce? Lettuce is not bitter, correct? Yeah, but I'm saying before the sandwich, we eat just plain lettuce, right? As the mitzvah of maror. Supposedly to remember the bitter times, but lettuce is not that bitter. Unless you mix horseradish into it. But lettuce itself is not that bitter. And yet it's one of the, if you don't have horseradish, it doesn't matter. You can just eat lettuce and you're still fulfilling the mitzvah, right? And the Shulchan Aruch explains an interesting thing. It says, yes, our lettuce that we eat is not bitter at all, but it's because we take it off the ground early. If you leave a thing of lettuce in the ground, it turns very bitter. So right now, what's that got to do with Egypt? That's actually what happened in Egypt. What happened was, the reason that the Jews became slaves, the Midrash tells us, they were a pretty prominent community already. By the time they became slaves, they were really, I mean, Jacob had come down, Joseph had brought down Jacob and his family, they had started to have a lot of children. They were becoming a real community. And suddenly Pharaoh enslaved them all because he was threatened, right? But how did he enslave them? That's not always so known. So Pharaoh came to them with a proposal. Join us. Become part of our team. We'll pay you handsomely. Like, he lured them into becoming part of the Egyptian culture. And then once they were, he enslaved them, right? And that's like the lettuce. It starts off sweet and ends up bitter, right? But he took it to a little bit of a different level and he explained a very nice thing. He said, the sweetness was more bitter than the bitterness. In other words, the bitterness was the hard work, the slavery. The sweetness was being lured into, being dissolved into part of another culture. And that's a problem. And when we eat the lettuce on Pesach night, we remember that. We eat it particularly when it's sweet. To remember that sweetness, that supposed sweetness that Pharaoh offered us, that we were attracted to or became part of, was actually the beginning of real bitterness. Same idea. In other words, the Torah tells us, the one who said this was Bilam, the false prophet, who was going to curse the Jewish people, and God didn't let him. So he blessed us instead, and he said some very powerful verses. And one of them he said is, Am levadad yishkon, we are a nation that dwells alone. Which is now very, very apparent, right? So we're a nation that dwells alone, but the Kabbalists explain that actually that verse can be understood two ways. We are a nation that dwells alone, which means we're isolated, we're abandoned, we're lonely, no one wants to support us. But it also means that there's a deeper reason, Amalavadad Yishkon, we need to understand and be proud of our uniqueness, our positive isolation, that we are a transcendent nation. We are something very unique, we have a unique mission, we have a unique connection, we have a deep connection, right? Every human being is created in the image of God. Every human being has a purpose. But there is something about that the Jews were chosen for a specific purpose. And this is born out in history. And sometimes when we forget this, we're reminded with the negative isolation. We're reminded you are a nation alone. Nothing's going to help you. Right? Anti-Semitism was never solved by assimilation. That's just a fact of history. Right? It's also a fact that we've never been destroyed because we are a miraculous, eternal nation. But also, it's never been solved by assimilation. The contrary, we need to be proud of who we are. We need to nurture our identity. And that's part of the same thing, that even if we have been assimilated, there's always a comeback. There's always hope. Now, so that's the concept. I want just like this idea of the vegetable, the ground becoming part of the Seder, the idea that no matter how much we become part of a different, we've lost our identity, we can always come back. And that's the hope that's necessary to understand when we talk about the journey of the Seder. I want to just break this down a little bit and just share with you a couple of other insights which I find very inspiring. And also, again, some general knowledge to take away with you for the Seder. So, at the Seder, we have 4 cups of wine. Right? Yep. There's a mitzvah to drink 4 cups of wine at different stages of the Seder. I say wine, by the way, it doesn't necessarily be wine. It could be grape juice, but wine, right? Something that's called wine, halachically. By the way, also, it doesn't have to be like the sweet stuff that people use for Shabbat, because that's actually not necessary. I've told you this before, right? People think you have to have Kiddush wine, which is like the sacramental, really hard stuff to drink on Friday night. You don't, by the way. You have to have kosher wine, but it doesn't have to be hard to drink sacramental wine. Unless you like it, of course, but...
Can it be white?
On Pesach night, there's a concept of being red, but it doesn't have to be. You fulfill the mitzvah of being white also, it's fine, yeah. By the way, just a side point, do you know how sacramental wine came into being while people think you need it for Kiddush? Very funny historic background. So there was a time in America before the war, I think even, where there was something called a prohibition. You weren't allowed to sell alcohol, right? And there was an exemption for religious purposes. So Manischewitz, famous Manischewitz company, produced this Kiddush wine. But in those days, there wasn't any good kosher sweet red wine or dry wine or quality wine. It was just like this horrible stuff, this sweet wine, right? So they produced the sacramental Kiddush wine, which they called Kiddush wine. They had to call it with a religious name because then it was permitted to actually sell. And it stuck. So till today, people think that when you come to Friday night, you have to buy something called Kiddush wine. You don't. You have to buy kosher wine, of course, but any kosher wine. And there's some really good kosher wines in the market nowadays. So when it comes to... Right? Interesting, no? You thought you need Kiddush wine? A lot of people do. No, you don't have to have Kiddush wine. It's better wine. It has to be kosher, but you can't make Kiddush wine on kosher wine. I mean, you shouldn't drink kosher, not kosher wine, but I'm saying, for Kiddush especially, but there's some really good kosher wines on the market, so treat yourself. When it comes to Pesach, there's 4 cups of the stuff you have to drink, so don't torture yourself with 4 cups of Kiddush wine. Do me a favor. Right?
And grape juice.
Yeah, you could have grape juice. Yeah, of course. Yes. I'm saying, but if you want to drink wine, like that, then don't torture yourself a sacramental wine. Just you can buy. There's some really good Tepperberg, Kedem. There's a lot of Baron Herzog. There's a really, really decent kosher wines that you can make it. Okay. Anyway, back to Pesach. Sorry?
Thank you.
Yeah, well, hopefully. I'll have to ask him for commission. No, I'm just kidding. So we have 4 cups of wine. Why do we have 4 cups of wine? Anyone else? Simple reason is because they made a mitzvah of 4 cups of wine because in the Torah there are 4 expressions of redemption. When God said to Moses to tell the Jewish people he's going to redeem them, he said, I will take you out, I will save you, I will redeem you, and then I will take you as my nation. Right? There's 4 expressions of redemption, that's why you have 4 cups of wine. But there's also lots of different explanation and interpretation. I want to share with you one that is so in theme of what we're saying now, that we have to believe in the power of personal exodus. We have to believe that we can grow even if we think we're stuck. We're not stuck. We always have that ability to grow. So I'm going to show you 2 ideas. One of the 4 cups of wine and 1 other thing. So there's a concept in the Talmud. In the time of the temple, there was a sacrifice that people would bring when they went through a challenging or dangerous situation. They would thank God. It's called a Korban Todah, an offering of thanksgiving. Today we don't have that sacrifice, but there's a blessing people make called Hagomel that they make if they've gone through one of these things. What are the 4 things? If a person was incarcerated, especially in an oppressive regime where actually it was dangerous, not just uncomfortable, then when you come out of prison, you make that bracha. If someone was seriously ill, dangerously ill, when they recover, you make the blessing. If someone traveled through a desert, which was especially in olden times, which was it could be very dangerous with wildlife and things like that. You have to make that blessing. And if someone travels through an ocean, ocean travel was considered dangerous. If you come out, you thank God for that particular thing. So they say, so there's four situations, four specific designated situations where you have to give a special thanks to God for coming through okay. When the Jews left Egypt, all four things happened. First of all, Egypt itself was like one giant prison. So leaving Egypt was like coming out of a prison. We are told that when 40, don't forget that coming out of Egypt and receiving the Torah at Mount Sinai 49 days later is all connected. And we say that when God gave the Torah at Mount Sinai, the Talmud tells us that all those that were sick was such a miraculous event. All those that were unwell became well. So that was a sick person becomes well. They crossed the sea, quite miraculously, but they crossed the sea, the Kriyat Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea. And they spent 40 years in the desert. So all those four things are connected to the exodus from Egypt. And therefore we have the four cups of wine. But it goes deeper than that. And these four things represent like the excuses, the barriers to growth. The first barrier to growth is being stuck in our own prison. Just so, no reason, just I am who I am. Don't tell me to change. So I've stuck myself into my own incarceration. So one cup of wine is to teach us that no, you're not stuck. You actually can go out of prison. Right? The second is, I'm too old and weak. That's the choleh, the sick person. Maybe when I was younger, I had more strength. Maybe I could do it. Maybe I could take a leap of growth. Maybe I could improve. Maybe I can better my personality. Maybe I can become more spiritual. And so on and so forth. But now it's hard. I'm weak. So we're seeing a second cup of wine. When Jews were also weak and they got healed at Mount Sinai, we can also become healed. Spiritually speaking, we can heal ourselves. We're not held back by weakness. We're not held back by frailty. Sometimes we get stuck because we live a life of emptiness. The more lack of meaning we experience, the more stuck we get in living a life of, we think of pleasure, of hedonism, of lack of purpose. It doesn't make us happy. This is what Viktor Frankl's whole thesis was based on, that people have to have meaning and purpose. But nevertheless, the default position of many human beings is to pursue the immediate pleasure, the instant gratification, and to be caught up in what we call emptiness. Emptiness is the midbar, the desert. A desert is a symbol of emptiness. So we take the third cup of wine and we say, no, we can actually go out of that emptiness. It doesn't matter how long we've been immersed or attached to lack of purpose or meaning, we can attach ourselves to meaning and purpose. We can. The fourth excuse people give that they can't grow is because we have external challenges, the turbulence of life, which is the symbol of the ocean. Why is the ocean dangerous? Not because there's wildlife there, but because of the turbulence, the waves, the currents, the high tides, and so on and so forth. That represents, and a lot of sort of literature points to that the concept of an ocean, called in Tanakh, Mayim Rabim, the turbulent waters, is what holds us back. The turbulence of life, the challenges, the ups and downs, the distractions, the difficulties, the getting through, the earning a living, the external challenges, the internal challenges, all those things, that's the ocean of life. But they cross the ocean. And that's the four cups. So the four cups of wine is this idea that we drink the four cups of wine to remind ourselves. Wine is a symbol of personal exodus. Because what is wine? Wine, by definition, is taking something which is otherwise hidden and revealing it. That's the wine. You take the juice that was, right? You take the juice that was hidden. Before the juice was extracted from the grape, it wasn't wine. It was just the grape. When you extract it and you ferment it and you maintain that it becomes something of great prominence and great importance, something that's been, from time immemorial, sort of a prominent drink on which we always praise God and we do blessings over Shabbat, weddings, Brit, all these things, we all use wine, right? Wine also reveals, there's a saying in the Talmud, Nichnas Yayin, when wine comes in, the secrets come out. That's good news for some, bad news for others. But right? But what it means spiritually speaking is that we all have a secret within us. We have the power of freedom. We have the neshama. We have that pintalayid. We have that little spark, right? That is always pure, that is always able, that we can always connect to and become free with. That part of the soul, that fifth layer of the soul that we always talk about, that is infinite, that is pure, that can always just sometimes hidden. So that's why on Pesach night, what we do is we have the four cups of wine, which represents the four different confusion areas of life that holds us back from growing. But we tell ourselves that we can, each one, we can break away from. We can experience freedom in each one of those areas. Why? Because we have that fifth level. Where's the fifth cup? We don't drink the fifth cup. Where's the fifth cup of the Seder? Right, the cup of Eliyahu HaNavi. That's the cup of redemption. What is Eliyahu HaNavi? Eliyahu HaNavi is the one who's going to tell us, who's going to herald in the coming of the Mashiach, right? That's what it says in the Talmud. And therefore, the fifth cup is the symbol of freedom, symbol of redemption. It represents the fifth part of the neshama, the fifth part of the soul, that pure part, the part that is always redeemed, the part of us that's always free, just hidden. But that part is then inspires and ignites the freedom on all the other four layers, which is our personal prison, our own frailty, our emptiness, and our turbulence. And we break free and we experience freedom on all four layers. I just want to share with you another inspiring insight that I learned this year, a few months ago. I always wondered about this, and I learned something. I discovered a book that's written from someone in America. Actually, it's a funny story. I discovered it because my daughter, who's in seminary in New York, I was talking to her one night, and she said a beautiful parsha here, and she told me an idea. And I said, "Where did you get it from?" She said, "The teacher got it from this book, and I never heard of the book." So I have a computer program at home which stores. I've got like a virtual library, like thousands, hundreds of thousands of books. It's called Otzara Chachma, a beautiful computer program. So I went looking for it and I found it and had some really nice insights. So the insight is like this. You know that Moses was the leader of the Jewish nation that took us out of Egypt, right? He was the messenger of God that to redeem us from Egypt. But it wasn't so simple. Moses actually wasn't in Egypt for a while. He had to run away. And he was working for his father-in-law, Yitro. And the famous story, which the Chumash tells us, which was the beginning of the whole journey of Exodus, is that Moshe Rabbeinu is shepherding the sheep one day, and he sees this bush, the burning bush, right? The burning bush was a phenomenon. It was burning, but it wasn't being consumed. Whatever that means, that's enough for another talk. And he comes closer, and he says, "Let me just see what's going on here." And it's the voice of God. It's the first godly revelation that he really had, then God calls out to him. And God tells him, "You are designated, you are the one who's going to go down to Egypt, go speak to Pharaoh, speak to the Jewish people, and you will redeem the Jewish people." That's the famous part of the story. What's not so famous is the nuances of the verses, coupled with the commentary that we're given from the Talmud and the Midrashim and so on. This discussion didn't take 10 minutes, it took 7 days. Why did it take 7 days? Because Moshe Rabbeinu argued with God for 7 days. He didn't want to go. Didn't think he was worthy. Now, in a way, that's a good sign of leadership when you're not rushing to become like the next great politician or something, but you're actually reserved about it. And you're not sure if you're the worthy one and maybe it should be someone else and so on. That's a good part. But there was a part that God got angry with him actually. He said, "Okay, it's 7 days, that's enough. You're going." And that's it. And of course, Moses became Moses. He became the leader, right? But there was a part of the discussion that was interesting. When Moses turns to God and he says, "I can't go because Vehein lo ya'aminu li." When I come down to Egypt and I approach the Jewish community, I know what they're going through. They are enslaved. They're persecuted. They're down. They have despair. They're not going to trust me. Why not going to trust me? Because they're so stuck there that they're not going to even want to. You know, the biggest problem of being stuck in exile is you don't want to become free. A slavery mentality where you're so stuck spiritually and physically both that they have no hope. They're not even going to trust that I'm a representative of God. It's not in their world. They're not expecting redemption on any level. They're going to think you're just a fraud. So God turns to him, this all in the verses in Exodus, in Shemot. God says to him, "Ma ze biyadecho?" What's in your hand? What are you holding? And at the time, Moshe Rabbeinu was holding his staff, his stick, right? So he says to God, "Mateh, I'm holding a stick." So Hashem says, "Throw it on the floor." Throws it on the floor and it turns into a snake. Right? Miracle, turns into a snake. Simple reading of that is, that's like a miracle that you're going to perform, so they'll see that you're a good guy, right? That you're not an imposter. But then God says, "Okay, now I want you to take the tail of the snake and pick it up." And he picks it up and it turns back into a stick. Okay, so he says, when you go there, you'll perform this miracle and they're going to believe you. Then he gives him a second sign and a second. Okay. So this particular author asked the question, he says, that's very nice. God wanted to give him something miraculous to do, some miraculous stunt, so to speak, to perform. So they'll know that he was designated by God, but why this one? What's the symbolism of throwing down a stick and it should become a stake, but then also picking up the stake and it become a stick again? I mean, why didn't God just turn it back into a stick? Or what was the? It seems like that's part of the miracle. And he says it was a very, very deep miracle. What's a stick? What does a stick mean? A staff that you hold, right? It's a symbol of support. It's a symbol of carrying someone to be able to be strong. It's a symbol of hope, really. It's strength. Symbol of strength. Symbol of hope. What's a snake? A snake is the symbol of impurity. Kabbalistically, we talk about the Nahash HaKadmoni, the very original snake. The snake in the Garden of Eden that caused Adam and Eve to sin. And Kabbalistically, we are taught that when God created the world, He created good and bad. But before the sin of the fruit, all bad, all evil, all tum'ah, impurity, was encapsulated in the snake. It wasn't released into the world. Right? And then when the snake, with all of his intense evil, came and persuaded Adam and Chava to eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, and the whole story, from that, it altered the whole course of history, right? Where impurity was then released out of the snake into the world, and since then we are taught that there's no good without bad, there's no bad without good. It's all a mixture. It's all cholent kind of thing, right? Of bad and good. Okay. So therefore, the concept of the snake is considered the ultimate evil. Ultimate slyness of evil. Right? So God says, take your stick and throw it on the ground and it becomes a snake. What's that? That's the symbol of complete failure. When someone descends from the tower of strength into the depths of snakehood.
Sorry, guys.
All good? Yep. No problem. Right? From the heights of strength into the depths of being like a snake. Okay? A symbol of failure. So that was like the Jewish people who had descended. They come from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rachel, Rivka, Leah. Right? And they had gone into Egypt, assimilated, gone down into the depths of impurity, being persecuted physically, spiritually, everything. Become part of the pagan culture. They become like a snake, the 49th level of impurity. So God says to Moses, I understand why you're asking me the question. And you ask me the question, and they're not going to trust me. They're so low, they become like the snake. And you think a snake can't become back into strength. Now I want you to pick up the tail. Picks up the tail and it comes back into a stick. Says, see, it doesn't matter. If you're a snake, you can still become a staff. That's the depth of that miracle. And that's the lesson for us. It doesn't matter. When we sit down to the Seder night on Pesach night, we need to know, it doesn't matter where we've been the whole year round. It doesn't matter how much we've grown or we haven't grown. It doesn't matter how stuck we think we are. We can think to ourselves, we can be in complete despair, believing that we cannot change even one millimeter. But it's not true. Even if you think, which we should never think about ourselves, but even if we think dishonestly, we think that we're like a snake, it doesn't matter. Pesach gives us the energy we can return to become a power of strength. We just have to believe it. We have to be ready to go beyond ourselves. It's about perspective. It's about changing a whole way of looking at things. That's true of everything, right? It's about changing the way and believing that we can take that exile, we can take that slavery, that inner slavery, and bring it back into freedom. Which goes into so many different themes in the Seder. One of them, for example, is we dip the bitter herbs into charoset, right? Now, Ashkenazi charoset, at least, is made with apples, right? You know that? Yeah. Say Ashkenazi because the Sephardim make it with dates. But it doesn't matter. It's both fruit that the Jewish people are compared to. So in Kabbalah, we learn that the charoset, part of the idea is to remember the bricks and the mortar, but also part of the idea is to remember the miraculous birth of the Jewish people, because there's a beautiful medrash that the women, that was in the merit of the Jewish women in Egypt, that the Jews were redeemed from Egypt. Right? Why? Because you remember that Pharaoh had made a decree that the boys should be thrown into the river. And the men were tired and they were working and they were slaves. And they didn't want to procreate, they didn't want to have children. And it says that the women enticed the men, and the whole story that they came and they made them food and they enticed them, they would come back home from a very, very long day of slavery, and they were intimate and they became pregnant and they had to give birth to their children. But now the women knew that it's dangerous to give birth, because what happens if it's a boy and then Pharaoh comes and he takes the boy and throws it in the river? So the Medrash tells us that we were born miraculously, that they went into the apple orchards, right? And they used to give birth to their babies, and the angel would come and whisk these babies away and send them back when they're a bit older. That's what it says. And it's hinted in a verse in Tanakh, Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, which says that God says to the Jewish people, Tachat HaTapuach Orarticha, I awakened you, I gave birth to you under the apple tree. So the apple is the symbol of the miracle of the Jewish people. It's the miraculous soul that we have, the eternity of the Jewish nation. What do we do at the Seder? We think sometimes that we've gone astray. We think we've become stuck. We're in our own prison. We think we cannot come back. Same problem. But it comes again and again, the reminder at the Seder, that's not true. What do? We take the bitter herbs. Sometimes we get stuck in the bitterness of who we are. And we despair. And what do? We dip the maror into the charoset. We dip it into the miracle of the soul. To show that no, even that bitterness can be dipped into charoset and can make a comeback. So the point I wanted to make today is that the first step to inner freedom is we have to believe that it's possible. And even when it seems miraculous, that miracle is given to us by the Seder. The Seder is a very holy experience. And a time that we tap into the energy of freedom. Once we believe that we can, then we have to look at the strategies of growth. What are the strategies to become inwardly free? How do we do that? How do we grow? How do we go beyond ourselves? How do we go out of our comfort zone? How do we do that? And that's also hinted in the Seder in many, many different ways and in the Haggadah. And that we'll do next week, please God. So come back for part two and we'll talk about the strategy.